This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi. Fair trade is a trading partnership based on dialogue, transparency and respect that seeks greater equity in international trade. Now, it balances on the principle of sustainable development and works to secure better trading conditions for marginalized producers and workers. Internationally renowned Sheikh Faraz Rabbani, founder of Seeker's Guidance, is with me and he'll explain more on this principle of sustainability, fairness, equity and workers' rights in relation to faith. Welcome to the show, Sheikh Faraz.
Thank you very much.
You know, could we sort of go through the basic principles of fair trade?
The way I understand it, fair trade emerges from a concern for the workers and producers in developing countries and elsewhere that the power relationship between large corporations and buyers is imbalanced towards the corporations mm-hmm. and these buyers, so that the producers and very often the small-scale farmers and others don't get even a sustainable wage and are not able to secure a basic just living standard for themselves and their families. At best, they may be able to scrape by, but if one disaster happens or one fluctuation in international markets and they're devastated or in debt. So the fair trade movement seeks to promote better pricing and better terms mm-hmm. for the producers themselves, who are very often at a negotiating disadvantage with these major buyers.
Right. In a Sheikh Faraz, I mean, you hail from Canada. You were born and bred a Muslim. Why the interest in fair trade, for an example?
Personally, in my own life story, I was very interested right from high school in international development. And were it not for my father, I would have studied international development at university.
What did you end up studying?
But I ended up studying economics okay. and just became a floater, a thinker at university and an activist. But it was an area of major concern throughout my university studies and then later my Islamic studies because of that principle of justice and fairness. And also as someone who hails in origin from a developing country, my origins are in India and Pakistan, and having grown up in much of my life as well in developing countries, though I'm a Canadian, it was a matter of grave concern that there are hundreds of millions of people who are in dire poverty, despite producing some of the most valued goods that people across the world enjoy. For example, I'm a great lover of coffee.
Oh.
And if you look at how some of the best coffees that are celebrated and people consume, how the coffee producers fare and how little they get of the share of the final price of coffee, it is a matter of concern, not just for a person of religion, but also for any person of conscience mm-hmm. that things should be otherwise.
Right. And you have decided to disseminate a lot of this information on faith, the relationship between faith and fair trade. Just to give an example, NGOs and many faith-based organizations have all been instrumental in promoting fair trade. Is an Islamic perspective on fair trade also supportive?
Most definitely, because one of the foundational principles in our religion is that the human being is responsible and we have choices that we make. We make spiritual choices, but we also make worldly choices. And in those choices, we seek not only the good for ourselves, but faith tells us that we seek the good for ourselves and for others, and that none of you truly believe until they wish for others of the good as they wish for themselves, mm-hmm. said the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. So this concern for justice for others, not just in one's own immediate and direct dealings, but the broader social, public, and global good is something that is really at the heart of any committed believer's concerns, whether they be a Muslim or persons of other faiths.
Right. You're here visiting Malaysia as part of there's going to be a talk in Johor. Have you finished that talk already? Or are you going to it?
Well, we were in Johor Bahru before, and we have a series of programs here
in KL as well. What makes you want to, you know, come right across the world? I mean, Canada is far away. I mean, what brings you here to spread such knowledge?
Well, it's rather related to the fair trade movement in one sense, in that, you know, we are in a global village. And, for example, I teach at an online academy, and we have hundreds, if not thousands of students in this part of the world. And people now increasingly are able to communicate with one another in wherever they may be. Mm-hmm. Even if they're living in a rural part of Bangladesh, they can still follow a scholar who's living in Canada or the US or in Australia. And this globalization, which has in many ways exacerbated problems of economic disempowerment, because it also very strongly empowers corporations, but it also shows a way forward for us in our quest for justice and fair trade, in that if rightly equipped and rightly supported and rightly empowered, individual producers and small-scale businesses are able to reach markets that they otherwise could not reach.
Mm-hmm. Right. How have people been? Have they been receptive to your talks and, you know, something like, you know, religion and fair trade? I don't think many people actually go to the ground and talk very much about it in this country.
Yes, it's in many ways a breath of fresh air, in that people are very, very troubled often if they see religion as being something purely personal. Because many people in our times living in this fast-paced life that all of us live in the global village, they cannot help be troubled by so much that we see. And if they have a set of religious or moral or ethical values that they hold fast to, but then they find out that the chocolate that they're eating is sourced from countries where this very successful and profitable global market for chocolate is a means for economic and human devastation, people are naturally troubled. And increasingly we see that even at the level of individuals, as consumers, a lot of the things that we buy are really produced through the blood and tears of people who are in debt. That there's cotton producers in many parts of the world who commit suicide by the thousands. Why? Even though the shirts that are made from that cotton are produced by the highest fashion labels in the world, yet how much of that benefit accrues to the people who put in the most significant hard work? The cloth itself, where did it come from? So the call is not just to support fair trade as a movement, but also to really consider that we are not powerless in front of these large corporations, but that we have choices to make, and that we should strive as individuals, even just purely as consumers, to make ethical choices, to strive to find out who made the product that I'm purchasing, how was it made, were the workers paid a fair wages, were they treated fairly, was there justice in this? And fair trade as a movement and as a certification process facilitates that to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Do you think fair trade can be a principle of unity in a time of division like this?
Fair trade would definitely be a source of unity, in that it, as a global standard, it facilitates people with similar concern, whether they be coming from a faith-based concern or a justice-based concern, or out of concern for the development of a particular area or the producers themselves, to come together on a common concern. And in our times, this is something that is very critical, because one of the other aspects of technology and the internet particularly is that people imagine it to be connecting people together. Mm-hmm. But in reality, as Cass Sunstein, one of the leading American legal thinkers and intellectuals of our time, he has a fascinating book called Going to Extremes, how modern technology pigeonholes people. So increasingly people simply talk to more and more people of more and more similar ideas to them. And even within individual countries, mm-hmm. people who are left-leaning and right-leaning politically, they no longer talk very much to one another. Rather, they
not
talk,
enough dialogue.
Yeah,
as such.
They talk at one another, and the same thing happens with different faith communities and people from different economic and social concerns. So, movements like the Fair Trade Movement facilitate that dialogue. That whether someone is a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a person who does not have a faith, faith tradition that they ascribe to, that this is something that we can come together on for an undeniable greater good. No one would sit and say, yes, we believe the farmers should be economically wronged. No one would say that in principle. Yeah. And this is a practical way of securing some degree of economic empowerment.
Do Islamic principles and teachings encourage Muslim organizations to be equally active?
Definitely. A foundational principle of of the Islamic faith tradition is what God Almighty tells us in the Quran, that إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُ بِالْعَدْلِ وَالْإِحْسَانِ, that Allah commands only to what is just and virtuous. So the basis of any moral conduct, any right human choice, whether individual or collective, has to be on the basis of justice and virtue or excellence. And what is justice? And it's important for us in making right choices to appreciate what is justice. And this is why different faith traditions give us great wisdom, because they're based on higher principles and also very often on thousands of years of human reflection and wisdom. Mm-hmm. And the understanding of justice in the Islamic tradition is that justice is not simply the demanding of rights, nor simply is it the securing of rights, but that justice comes from fair balance. That a state of justice is when everyone and everything that has a right has its due rights. So it's balancing out rights. And that's something that one should generally consider, that as consumers, for example, that you have a right to seek the things that you like in life. But in seeking your right, pursue that right in the right way, so that make right choices. So when you go to, you're going to make a seemingly simple choice. I want to buy a cotton shirt. But just take that extra step. Find out how you can buy it in a manner that is not ending up being indirectly a party to injustice for the producers.
For those who think that's too much work, what would you like to say to them?
Well, human beings are lazy, and that's undeniable.
Complacent.
And we like to wiggle away from responsibility. But one of the benefits of standards is that they facilitate right choices. Right? And that's why a standard such as a fair trade standard facilitates for people to make a right choice. Because if you give people that choice, so if we use the example of coffee, for example, I go and buy coffee. And if I had to go and find out about each company whose coffee beans I want to buy or whose cup of coffee I want to drink, I probably wouldn't find out. Or might just be an exceptional for someone to find out. However, if there are clear, trustworthy standards that are meaningful, that this is fair trade, this is organic, this has particular relationships with the local producers, then it facilitates better choices. And that's really the benefit of fair trade.
When we come back, we'll find out more about fair trade and faith with Sheikh Faraz Rabbani. He's the founder of Seeker's Guidance on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi. Most of us talk about fair trade, never in the light of faith, for an example. But Sheikh Faraz Rabbani is with me. He's founder of Seeker's Guidance, hailing from Canada, originally from Pakistan. Yeah. Sheikh, what is the Seeker's Guidance before I actually go on?
We are a global educational organization, and our focus is on promoting Islamic knowledge, but also spirituality and service, in that for a meaningful living of religion, you need not only understanding of religion, but that understanding needs to be lived in spirituality. And that knowledge and spirituality should instill in one a sense of service. And service not just for one's fellow co-religionists, but it should instill in one a concern for the good of all one's fellow human beings and also for this world and environment that we live in. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Toronto, we have a project that we call Feed Me, and this which is to fight hunger in our area. And we have similar projects in other places where Seeker's Guidance operates, but we work with the local food banks, and people are surprised that a developed country like Canada has poverty, but there's, you know, 1 in 20 Canadians easily are what they call food insecure, that they're in poverty, and at least sometime during the year they need to seek recourse of a food bank.
Mm-hmm. And that's quite a lot.
It's a lot of people, because the social safety net has a lot of holes, and because of the growth of conservative political thought, and right now we have a conservative government in Canada, those holes have been becoming bigger. Mm-hmm. So I was overseas for 10 years, and when I came back, I was shocked that now in downtown Toronto, in a country that has a very strong social tradition like Canada, you find many people sleeping on the street. They sleep on these vents because Canada gets freezing cold. Mm-hmm. We have snow even in April.
Yeah.
Yet they're sleeping on the vents on the street. And as a person of faith, one must have concern for such matters. And so we work with the local food banks to encourage people from within our community, within the Muslim community, to support these food banks by giving donations, by giving food, by volunteering their time, but not simply to engage within our Muslim community. But hunger is a matter of common concern that none of you believes until they wish for others of the good as they wish it for themselves.
Yeah.
And these kinds of projects also create linkages within society. So we've collaborated with South Asian groups who are concerned with similar matters. The food banks are all mainstream food banks. There's Christian groups that we've worked with and presented with and so on. And very interestingly, of course, the name of this campaign, Feed Me, which is taken from a prophetic tradition, which relates that God Almighty asks on the Day of Judgment the servant that, oh my servant, I was hungry and you fed me not. And the servant says, oh Lord, you're the Lord of the worlds. How could I feed you? And God Almighty says, did you not know that my servant so-and-so was hungry? Had you fed them, you would have found me with them.
Mm-hmm.
And what is fascinating is exactly the same tradition is mentioned in the Bible. And Martin Luther King Jr., the great civil rights activist and Christian leader, one of the great men of the 20th century, he quoted this tradition from the Bible in his final speech before he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So these social concerns create bridges of understanding, of appreciation, of concern, and hopefully of collaboration between people of different traditions, which is something desperately needed in our times. And the same applies, of course, to the fair trade movement as well.
Why do you think it's so difficult to create these social bridges?
Sometimes the social bridges are rectified because people are thinking too much of themselves, mm-hmm, as individuals or as our group, and not thinking sufficiently of the broader common concerns. And it is important. Everyone has their identity and everyone has their individual and group concerns, and those are not denied. But part of the wisdom of God's creating us as different tribes and faiths and communities and peoples is for us to not only recognize our differences and be tolerant and accepting of them and to respond to those differences in dignified ways, but also not to lose sight of our commonalities, of our common concerns, of the common issues that all of us should be worried about if we live up to whatever principles that we hold ourselves to. And on those matters, to come together. Right? And this instills in us principled living and fulfills really the human potential that everyone has.
Is fair trade widely practiced in countries under Islamic influence? Pakistan, for an example, where you come from, and we always hear of the carpet industry and how much exploitation there is. I mean, is it a question of ignorance or, you know, fair awareness? What is it?
Yes, so fair trade is not sufficiently practiced, both at the level of the consumer, right, at the level of consumers in developing countries, whether Muslim or others. And also there is not this clearly not sufficient understanding of the opportunities that fair trade presents in individual producers, whether it be in individual farmers or small-scale corporations. And it's not a simple matter because a lot of people are mired in debt. And that's part of the, you know, one of the unwitting instruments of global capitalism is that farmers and producers are so mired in debt that they are stuck in economic relationships that they really can't get out of. They don't want to be there, but they can't get out of there because they're in debt for more than they could repay in a lifetime or two or three. So it is very important for us to be very proactive in raising awareness at the level of the individual economic producers, farmers, and others, but also to strive to influence governments in developing countries, that they should take principled stances so that the foreign corporations and foreign governments that wield an extraordinary amount of influence in framing trade relationships do so in ways that are not of the ultimate disadvantage both to individuals in these developing countries, but also ultimately to the development of those countries. There's a clear concept in development economics of underdevelopment, that there's a lot of production taking place, and you see entire continents that are very productive and have a great deal of natural resources, but this international trade leads to structural unemployment and underdevelopment. And generally, who benefits truly from much of that trade are a very small segment of the wealthy in both the developing countries and also, sadly, in the developed countries as well. Right. There's a fascinating recent book, if I could just finish on, called The Plutocrats, about how much of the world's wealth is not just in the 1% that the Occupy movement was complaining against, but in reality, it's the 0.1%. both in the developed world and the developing world, that is benefiting from an extraordinary amount of the wealth. Right? And the author, she looked at what was the wealth in pre-modern times, the wealthiest people in history, and the great plutocrats of our times are far more wealthy in comparison to the common person, in comparison and in the degree of their economic and political influence than people in pre-modern times before democracy, before notions of economic rights and other matters. So we as consumers, we have to understand, right, that you are not, as individuals, we have to understand that you're not merely a passive consumer, but that you are a person who has principles that you believe in, that none of us would say that we don't care about our fellow human being. And the faith tradition that one comes from, would any meaningful faith tradition instills in one concern for others, so that we should make those principled choices. And sometimes it's a question also of perhaps doing without something. Instead of buying four sets of clothes, buy two, mm-hmm. but your conscience can be at rest, that at least you've made a meaningful choice that will not only get you something that you are seeking, but that will preserve the rights that others are seeking as well.
Would you say fair trade sort of falls between capitalism and socialism?
Fair trade is based on modern capitalist notions and of free markets and so on, but it is grounded in a degree of social concern. But there's a broader reality too, which is that one of the things that we need to very seriously in our times to preserve is the sense of community as well. And I learned that with an interesting example from my parents. I live right next door to my parents in one of the suburbs of Toronto. And I noticed that my parents go and shop at this local at an Italian store that's in a strip mall right next to where we live. And it's a small little store that has Italian goods, and we don't have any roots in Italy. And I asked my mom one day, that, "Mom, why do you shop at that Italian store? It has higher prices than the supermarket." And the supermarket is just a block away. And my parents, because they're now both retired, they walk almost daily to the supermarket as well and do their they buy day to day. So they get some exercise in. So I asked my mom that, why do you shop from that Italian store? And she looked at me with this the mother's look that, you don't, really don't get it, do you? And she said, look, he's our neighbor.
Right.
If we don't buy from our neighbor, who will? Says he has a family. He has sons and daughters, and we know them. Because they've been living in that area for the last 20 years. Says, and we know them. My father was actually concerned that that Italian shop doesn't get enough business. So he asked him, said, you told me once that you used to be a barber. Can you start cutting my hair?
Right.
So he goes to the basement of
the little Italian and gets his hair cut.
That, and it's not just an aspect of supporting local business, but to have those real human relationships. That you may be a Muslim, but the local grocery store owner may be a Christian, may be a Hindu. And those real relationships, right, are very powerful because they create communities. They also economically empower those local communities, which does not mean that one does not buy from major corporations, but to also to realize that there's much more to our choices than merely which one is cheaper.
Yeah.
Right. And also it preserves culture, right? Because we are being flattened by monoculture, and which is profoundly disturbing at the level of the human psyche. That if you're losing your identity, your traditions, your culture, the food that you ate, the relationships that you had, etc., it's profoundly dehumanizing. So supporting local businesses, and not just businesses of people from one's own community, but in most places you have different communities that are there, and we should actually take proactive steps to make those kinds of choices. So one of the things I used to do after Friday prayer, I'd take some friends of mine, and we'd go to one of the Jewish neighborhoods in Toronto and have lunch there. And which is a very good opportunity for dialogue. Not any kind of proselytizing, but just dialogue. And very often the shop owners or the person working there would be surprised that
many people wouldn't do that.
Yes. But this is what builds understanding. Right? And you have very interesting dialogue, and you appreciate where they're coming from, and they appreciate where you're coming from, and it's profoundly humanizing. Right? And those kinds of steps are very important to take. Right? Why? Because in seeking the broader good, we have to create bridges of human relationships, of human understanding. And it's only when we begin to communicate with one another, as different social groups, as different religious groups, as different even political groups, only when that greater dialogue takes place can there be understanding and constructive cooperation towards greater good.
Would you then say there are indeed strong and clear faith-based reasons for supporting fair trade initiatives?
Most definitely. The underlying call of the Islamic faith tradition and legal tradition for justice and of concern for the other, and that you cannot be a true believer until you live genuine concern for others. In fact, the Prophet, peace and blessings upon him, even said that religion itself is sincere concern. And it has two aspects. There's concern for God, expressed through one's worship and one's devotion, but also concern for God's creation. But it's not concern that you just sit back and say, oh, I feel so bad about people dying here and people oppressed there. But how are you living that concern? Mm-hmm. And practically, at our individual level, it is expressed in the choices that we make. That when you buy, that's a major choice. When you invest, it's a major choice. And that choice has potentially very positive consequences. And of course, similarly, when we make political choices and how we live our lives, so that you're not merely a consumer, but you are someone who is seeking the good. And it's only, interestingly, when someone is genuinely seeking good for others that they find contentment.
Mm-hmm. It probably goes back to the fact that, you know, we are becoming more and more individualistic.
Yes.
And that is of concern, actually. And this is exactly what you're trying to dispel, that we need to do something. We need to break out of that whole idea of being individualistic.
Yes, there's an aspect of individualism that's undeniable. At the end of the day, each of us begins by being responsible for ourselves and our own lives. But the danger of the degree of individualism that has emerged in our times is that it ultimately leads to lesser contentment for the individual. And it's a consequence of modern economics. There's a fascinating book by a Harvard economist called The Miserable Science, about how modern economics makes people, hurts individuals and relationships and society. Because if you posit yourself as simply being an economic animal, and the choices that you make, you're primarily concerned about your own material well-being, it's going to hurt your relationships as a spouse. And in Canada, for example, in the West in general, there's a common phenomenon of husband and wife are both working, and one of them got a better job offer 3,000 kilometers away, and for a few thousand dollars more, they live apart. Mm-hmm. And the children are with the mother, or between mother and father sometimes. And now, are you genuinely better off living apart like that, whether as husband and wife, whether with your children? What about your parents? What about your community? You had a network of social relationships that you've now been divorced from. What about some community work that you're engaged in? What about your religious life that was rooted in a particular area? So this individualism very often blinds us to our greater individual self-interest, because our self-interest, our happiness, is not simply in being a consuming animal. And part of taking a principled stand against excessive corporatism is to have self-awareness that I am not simply an individual economic agent, that I'm a human being, I'm part of a greater human reality. I live on this earth, and the air that I breathe and the water I drink affects me, myself, as well as others. Mm-hmm. So we need to broaden our concerns, and for that, fair trade is a good starting point. It is not the solution to all these things, but it's a step in the right direction. That it should facilitate right choices for us as consumers, but also in promoting it for producers in the developing world and elsewhere, it helps them secure their rights to a good degree as well.
It was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much.
Sheikh Faraz Rabbani, founder of Seeker's Guidance on Fair Trade and Your Faith on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.